Chapter 24.
Outside it was still snowing. City snow, drifting down in a wet curtain which soon lost itself in the dirty, churned-up slush in the streets. I pulled my coat higher round my neck and huddled deeper in the Bentley's leather luxury. As we swept past dark buildings and shops, I kept expecting Granville to turn up some side street and stop. But within a few minutes we were speeding through the suburbs up towards the North Road. This meeting, I thought, must be out in one of the country institutes, and I didn't say anything until we had reached Scotch Corner, and the big car had turned onto the old Roman road at Bowes. I stretched and yawned.
By the way, Granville, where are they holding this meeting?
Appleby, my colleague replied calmly. I came bolt upright in my seat, then I began to laugh.
What's the joke, old son?
Granville inquired.
Well, Appleby! Come on, where are we really heading?
I've told you, laddie. The Pemberton Arms, Appleby, to be exact.
Do you mean it?
Of course.
But hell, Granville, that's on the other side of the Pennines.
Quite right.
Always has been, laddie.
I ran a hand through my hair.
Wait a minute. Surely it isn't worth going about 40 miles in weather like this. We'll never get over Bowes Moor, you know. In fact, I heard yesterday it was blocked. Anyway, it's nearly 8 o'clock. We'd be too late.
The big man reached across and patted my knee.
Stop worrying, Jim. We'll get there and we'll be in plenty of time. You've got to remember you're sitting in a proper motor car now. A drop of snow is nothing.
As if determined to prove his word, he put his foot down and the great car hurtled along the dead straight stretch of road. We skidded a bit on the corner at Greta Bridge, then roared through Bowes and up to the highest country. I couldn't see much. In fact, on the top moor I couldn't see anything, because up there it was the real country snow. Big, dry flakes driving straight into the headlights and settling comfortably with millions of their neighbours on the already deep white carpet on the road. I just didn't know how Granville was able to see, never mind drive fast, and I had no idea how we were going to get back over here in a few hours' time, when the wind had drifted the snow across the road. But I kept my mouth shut. It was becoming increasingly obvious that I emerged as a sort of maiden aunt in Granville's company, so I held my peace and prayed. I followed this policy through Brough and along the lower road where the going was easier, until I climbed out with a feeling of disbelief in the yard of the Pemberton Arms. It was 9 o'clock. We slipped into the back of the room and I settled into my chair, prepared to improve my mind a little. There was a man on the platform holding forth, and at first I had difficulty in picking up the substance of his words. He wasn't mentioning anything about animal diseases, but suddenly everything clicked into place.
"We are indeed grateful," the man was saying, "to Professor Milligan for coming all this way and for giving us a most interesting and instructive talk. I know I speak for the entire audience when I say we have enjoyed it thoroughly, so may I ask you to show your appreciation in the usual manner."
There was a long round of applause, then an outburst of talk, and a pushing back of chairs. I turned to Granville with some dismay.
That was the vote of thanks. It's finished.
So it is, laddie.
My colleague didn't seem unduly disappointed, or even surprised.
But come with me. There are compensations.
We joined the throng of vets and moved across the richly carpeted hall to another room, where bright light shone down on a row of tables laden with food. Then I recognised Bill Warrington, the borough's welcome representative, and all became clear. This was a commercially sponsored evening, and the real action, in Granville's estimation, began right here. I remembered then that Siegfried had once told me that Granville hated to miss any of these occasions. Though the most generous of men, there was some piquancy in the gratis food and drink which attracted him irresistibly. Even now he was guiding me purposefully towards the bar. But our progress was slow due to a phenomenon peculiar to Granville. Everybody seemed to know him. Since those days I have been with him to restaurants, pubs, dances, and it has been just the same. In fact, I have often thought that if I took him to visit some lost tribe in the jungles of the Amazon, one of them would jump up and say,
"Well, hello, Granville, old boy," and slap him on the back.
Finally, however, he fought his way through his fellow vets, and we reached the bar where two dark little men in white coats were already under pressure. They were working with the impersonal concentration of people who knew that the whiskey always took a hammer in on veterinary evenings, but they paused and smiled as my colleague's massive presence hovered at the counter.
"Now then, Mr. Bennett. How are you, Mr. Bennett?"
"Good evening, Bob.
Nice to see you, Reg,"
Granville responded majestically. I noticed that Bob put down his bottle of ordinary whiskey and reached down for a bottle of Glenlivet malt to charge Granville's glass. The big man sniffed the fine spirit appreciatively.
"And one for my friend Mr. Herriot," he said.
The barman's respectful expressions made me feel suddenly important, and I found myself in possession of my own vast measure of Glenlivet. I had to get it down quickly, followed by a few speedy refills, since the barman took their cue from my companion's consumption. Then I followed in Granville's regal wake as he made his way among the tables with the air of a man in his natural environment. Messrs. Burroughs' welcome had done us proud, and we worked our way through a variety of canapés, savouries, and cold meats. Now and again we revisited the bar for more of the Glenlivet, then back to the tables. I knew I had drunk too much, and now I was eating too much. But the difficulty with Granville was that if I ever declined anything, he took it as a personal insult.
"Try one of those prawn things," he would say, sinking his teeth into a mushroom vol-au-vent,
and if I hesitated, a wounded look would come into his eyes. But I was enjoying myself. Veterinary surgeons are my favourite people, and I revelled as I always did in their tales of successes and failures, especially the failures. They were particularly soothing. Whenever the thought of how we were going to get home stole into my mind, I banished it quickly. Granville seemed to have no qualms because he showed no signs of moving when the company began to thin out. In fact, we were the last to leave, our departure being accorded a touch of ceremony by a final substantial stirrup cup from Bob and Reg. As we left the hotel, I felt fine. A little light-headed, perhaps, and with a merest hint of regret at being pressed to a second helping of trifle and cream, but otherwise in excellent shape. As we settled once more into the Bentley, Granville was at his most expansive.
"Excellent meeting that, Jim. I told you it would be worth the journey."
We were the only members of the company who were headed eastward, and we were alone on the road. In fact, it occurred to me that we hadn't seen a single car on the road to Appleby, and now there was something uncomfortable in our total isolation. The snow had stopped, and the brilliant moon flooded its cold light over a white, empty world. Empty, that is, except for us, and our solitary state was stressed by the smooth, virgin state of the glistening carpet ahead. I was conscious of an increasing disquiet as the great gaunt spine of the Pennines bulked before us, and as we drew nearer it reared up like an angry white monster. Past the snow-burdened roofs of Brough, then the long climb with the big car slipping from side to side as it fought its way up the bending, twisting hill, engine bellowing. I thought I'd feel better when we reached the top, but the first glimpse of the Bowsmoor Road sent my stomach into a lurch of apprehension. Miles and miles of it coiling its way across the most desolate stretch of country in all England. And even from this distance you could see the drifts, satin smooth and beautiful, pushing their deadly way across our path. On either side of the road a vast white desert rolled and dipped endlessly towards the black horizon. There was not a light, not a movement, not a sign of life anywhere. The pipe jutted aggressively as Granville roared forward to do battle. We hit the first drift, slewed sideways for a tense few seconds, and then we were on the other side, speeding into the unbroken surface. Then the next drift, and the next, and the next. Often I thought we were stuck, but always, wheels churning, engines screaming, we emerged. I had had plenty of experience of snow driving, and I could appreciate Granville's expertise as, without slackening speed, he picked out the shallowest, narrowest part of each obstruction for his attack. He had this heavy, powerful car to help him, but he could drive all right. However, my trepidation at being stranded in this wasteland was gradually being overshadowed by another uneasiness. When I had left the hotel, I was pretty well topped up with food and drink, and if I'd been handled gently for the next few hours, I'd have been all right. But on the bumpy journey to Brough, I had been increasingly aware of a rising queasiness. My mind kept flitting back unhappily to that exotic cocktail, Reggie's speciality, which Granville had said I must try. He had prevailed on me, too, to wash down the whiskies with occasional beers, which, he said, were essential to maintain a balanced intake of fluids and solids, and that final trifle, it had been a mistake. And now I wasn't just being bumped. I was being thrown around like a pea in a drum as the Bentley lurched and skidded and occasionally took off altogether. Soon I began to feel very ill indeed. And like a seasick man who didn't care if the ship floundered, I lost all interest in our progress. I closed my eyes, braced my feet on the floor, and shrank into an inner misery.